This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers' Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is a bonus podcast for the New Yorker Radio Hour. It was recorded at Public Forum, a series of events moderated by David Remnick at the Public Theater in New York. This event marked the first 100 days of the Trump administration. Joining David to talk about the challenges of covering this presidency were Lydia Pullgreen, editor-in-chief of The Huffington Post, Eli Lake, a correspondent for Bloomberg View, MSNBC host Joy Reid, and Washington Post reporter David Fahrenthold.
So it's 100 days of the Trump presidency. How are you feeling, okay? You're all right.
Whew.
Yeah. And the only good thing about, in my mind, Eli, you may disagree, the good thing about this is that time moves so slowly that we will never age. It'll be all right. 4 years will seem like 20, but it'll only be four. Everybody was worried in November that the press was going to come under fire, the First Amendment would be suspended, we'd all be in trouble. Meanwhile, I go to work, everything works, computers are on. No trouble, right, Lydia?
So far, so good.
Okay, but what is the relationship now between the press and the President of the United States? Is it any different than with any other president?
I mean, I would say that there is an extraordinary level of extremely intimate access to the president. I mean, I'm stunned by how many reporters he's talked to one-on-one, both informal and informal and informal settings. The difficulty with this is that nothing he says is of any use. I mean, if the president speaks and the things that he says don't make any sense, what are we supposed to do with that? I mean, what do we take away from that? What does access mean when there is no truth or falsehood to what the president's saying, if he's going to change his mind back and forth 1,500 times? So, I mean, it was very, very difficult to get access to the Obama White House, but if you got a sit-down with President Obama, you would make news on something of substance.
But to my question about the First Amendment and fears about attacks on the press, yes, he's attacked the fake news and he this, that, and the other thing, but he calls the New York Times failing and fake news. Same, you've gotten the same honorific at the Washington Post. I fear I have not been as blessed, but I live in hope. And for circulation reasons. But, you know, what are you bitching about?
Well, I think we...
I mean, my sense is that he talks to Maggie Haberman at the Times and the equivalents at the Washington Post more than most members of his family.
Trump sees the media as the most important barometer of him being of him succeeding as president. He sees us as the mirror of himself. He doesn't look to things beyond us. He looks to polls in some degree. He doesn't look to results. He looks to the media and how they're covering him as the daily barometer of whether he's succeeding or failing as president.
So he doesn't really hate you.
No, he needs us. No president has ever needed us to prop himself up or to reaffirm himself in the way that Trump does.
What's the difference between him and other presidents in that sense?
Well, I think other presidents had a sense that they ignored us in some cases. They tried to reach directly to the public. They had a sense of accomplishment that went beyond us or around us. And they didn't, I think rightly so, look to us as the people who would tell you you're doing a good job. And Obama talked famously about hating Morning Joe. He hated that sort of chattering class. And Trump, that kind of show, and I think it's more Fox and Friends now, that kind of show is where he turns to sort of, that's his view on the world. It's not the CIA or the FBI or whoever else. It's those folks.
I think it's a little bit more complicated than that, because his relationship, which is now on the outs with Steve Bannon, is deeply ideological, and it's deeply disruptive to what is a kind of elite right-left consensus on things like free trade and I think free immigration. And that represents a real challenge in a significant way. And I do think that there's an element of Trump that believes this. He's talked about China taking our jobs, even though his foreign policy has been very kind to China in recent weeks. But to sort of look at this in another way, we have a moment where I think those of us in the cosmopolitan elite, many consider themselves part of a resistance, and that Trump is a representative of a kind of American fascism. But I would submit that this kind of lack of any core, or to put another way, fascists are much better at consolidating power and implementing an agenda than Donald Trump has been in the last 100 days. And this in some ways should force us to rethink perhaps this mode of resistance politically, and to look at this more like an opposition, because there's plenty to oppose with Donald Trump. At least so far, though, I don't think he is that kind of extinction-level threat that we were all worried about back in November.
Well, you know, I think of Donald Trump as, if you look at this sort of 4 million people on average a night who watch Fox News, who watch the prime time in Fox News, if one of them were to become president tomorrow, they wouldn't be materially different than Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a guy who spends a lot of time watching Fox News and watching cable TV. To the extent that he has beliefs, they are no different than the beliefs of most of his voters. So he thinks sort of on a surface level, China bad. China is bad. They're hurting us. They're killing us on trade. But if you, to the point of the AP interview, sat down and tried to have a nuanced, detailed policy conversation with Donald Trump about China, you would get an incoherent sort of mumble, a jumble of sort of words that wouldn't really mean anything.
Which makes
because
you,
it doesn't have any policy depth.
Joy, makes you more afraid, or it makes you relieved? In other words, what I'm saying is, we've had 100 days, Hitler did not come to power, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, all those things that you thought he believed with unbelievable ferocity was all fungible. Well, he had 10 minutes with Chinese leadership.
Yeah.
Suddenly, not so much. You know, suddenly I liked him very much, and they're not currency manipulators.
He liked him. He's like, he likes me. And if he likes me, then I guess he's not so bad. I mean, I literally, the person who, and I won't take credit for it, said that it's malevolence tempered by incompetence. And that's why he isn't dangerous. Mm. If they were mildly competent, we'd be in trouble. But he is not only sort of, he's
but
surrounded
that's the, but that's
by
the question I'm asking. When competence comes into play, on situation like foreign affairs, where you might hope for some competence as opposed to hardcore ideology, that's another matter, is it not, Eli?
It is another matter. As somebody who, I'm very grateful that there is not a Yalta 2 conference with Russia right now, dividing up the world with this guy who just meddled in our election. That would be a disaster. Mm-hmm. Instead, what we have are pretty rocky relationship between the U.S. and Russia, and I've seen from the Trump administration, and you have to give him some credit. He appointed people, or he chose people for his cabinet who were much tougher on Russia than he campaigned. He said things that were outrageous for a president or a presidential candidate to say. He compared American leaders to Vladimir Putin, and he said, well, you know, we think we have killers. I mean, I couldn't believe that. I wrote a whole column called Code Pink Republican. In that respect, we should be glad that he wasn't competent in implementing this dangerous agenda of embracing Russia and thinking that they could be a reliable partner in a lot of ways. On the other hand, it should give us pause that if he can turn so quickly, he could turn again. But at the same time, we've gone from very haphazard first couple weeks to the beginning of a process. H.R. McMaster, I think, has begun to sort of implement a normal National Security Council, where various people have their turf fights, and it's beginning to look a lot more normal. And we just saw that, you know, they said some things about the Iran deal, but they recertified it. They haven't done these radical things that were promised, and I think in that sense, it's pretty good.
Now, Joy, it strikes me, if Mitt Romney or John McCain, in other words, another species of Republican, had committed any one of these sins, the effect on their electoral prospects and or presidencies would have been different. That Trump has something else. There's something else happening here about Trump where he's more immune.
I think he has appealed to that triumvirate of nationalist, particular nationalist views that are sweeping the entire world ever since 9/11. Islamophobia, which has swept Western Europe as well as the United States, a real anxiety about immigration, non-white immigration, and a hatred of free trade. Those things are very powerful. They're also, the third one, the trade one, is what drove Bernie voters too. So there's a real anxiety there that Trump taps into, so he doesn't need to know policy or know specifics. He sounds like them. Again, he is sort of in the same milieu as all the other guys watching Fox News his age. He sounds like them, and they like them no matter what he does.
The
traditional left-right, you know, parties are essentially... The dichotomy is essentially collapsing. I mean, none of the establishment parties that represent the traditional left or the traditional right, they were completely left out in the cold.
Eli, you wanted to respond?
I do think that there's a reason why Trump supporters called themselves the deplorables. And it wasn't just I think you're correct that they're concerned about Islam, immigration, and free trade. But, you know, it's true that if you have a job at Carrier, globalization may create more jobs in the American economy, but it won't create more jobs for you in your community. They have a point. For 30 years, American right and left elites have ignored their point of view. And the result is, in this election, these people who were angry and have been frustrated and feel like they've had their elites lie to them have been told that they have some sort of psychological ailment, that they're paranoid or they're deluded or something like that. I think that they became incredibly frustrated, and they saw Trump as the way in which to infuriate the elites that really couldn't found him so deplorable.
Trump as a hand grenade.
Yeah, and I think that there, I guess, and I consider myself as part of this cozy elite bubble. So I'm speaking as after the election. That is something that I really started thinking about, and you know, journalistically, which was, how did we miss this? And what is it that, why do we just assume all of these debates about free trade? And to a certain extent, and I have no patience for the anti-Muslim bigotry, but there is also a kind of elite way that we've spoken about the issue of Islam, as if we can never say that there are specific problems that are going on within that faith, or else we get into this zone of, oh my God, this is very problematic. You know, and I think that that opens up a space for real demagogues and bigots. So I don't know. I mean, I would have liked to have seen more self-reflection on the part of us, as opposed to sort of looking at these communities and saying, well, you know, this is just your superstition.
But can I just say, I just disagree with the idea that these people have been ignored. I think they are obsessed over. I think we spend so much time examining them and trying to understand
precisely
them.
Precisely, that's exactly right.
But by the way, American culture... throughout, particularly the 20th century, if you look at the whole early first half of the 20th century, who were the heroes? The cowboy, right? The Rosie the Riveter, the working man. There's a whole language of politics that is centered around the hardworking working class. Politics obsesses over them, the middle class. The waitress. Remember, we had waitress moms. We've had NASCAR dads. We've had soccer moms. All of them carved out as the group that you must win to win an election. There's never been a group that has had more sort of varieties of labels applied to them of why they are the important thing to win. You know, there was no equivalent of NASCAR dads about African-American voters ever. There's never been an obsession over any other group of voters like there is about white working class voters. We are obsessed with them. And the reality is nothing about the way they vote has changed in 100 years. They are conservative voters. There is an entire network called Fox News, which was created to reflect their point of view back to them 24 hours a day. Donald Trump is the human equivalent of Fox News. It's constituent service. He is serving them back what they believe. I get it. These are folks that want you know, what they see as red-blooded American values restored to centrality. They want to again be the center of the conversation as they were for the entire 20th century of the United States, right? So they want that back.
But what they'd say back...
I don't know.
What they'd say back is, no, the best of them. I'm not talking about the stone-cold racists among them. That they would say, look, I had a job in an auto factory, and by the way, so did my African-American brother or friend on the line.
When they'd let them in the union, because remember, that was a whole issue as well.
Totally fair enough, Joy. But now neither one of them have a job because of automation or globalization, and now they're both working at Walgreens, and then at night, and you know the whole story. Mm-hmm. And the resentment grows as much out of that as anything to do with the Muslims that they never see.
Sure, but they are then turning around and voting for the exact same candidates that the CEO of the company who outsourced their job vote for. I mean, it's actually a brilliant trick on the part of the Republican Party, is that the guy who's getting laid off on the line factory floor votes precisely the way the CEO of the company who's enriched by stock options by sending that job to Mexico is voting. They vote the same way.
Like, make a quick point.
Okay, but Trump is not your average Republican.
He's the CEO. That votes just like the factory
floor. I'm sorry. Yes, he is the CEO, but his message and when he got elected is, and what Fox News, they never had a debate about, you know, maybe we shouldn't join. I mean, the anti-NAFTA, the anti-trade voice was Ross Perot, as Pat Buchanan. It was the outcast, the mainstream Republican. Republicans continually nominated pretty middle-of-the-road people who did not offer them that debate. Trump comes along and he represents something very different.
But
and
those
I think we
same
have to
guys
that.
Voted for the elite version of the Republicans too. So it's not as if they've been rejecting Republican candidates who've supported outsourcing globalization. They've been voting for the seat. They vote for whoever is the Republican. Right, they voted for Mitt Romney too.
Let me wrestle this back into our topic of the press. Eli, a question on national security and the press. During the campaign, when the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta were hacked, famously, the then candidate, Trump, got up and said, "I love WikiLeaks." I believe that's a quote. A week ago, the Trump-appointed director of the Central Intelligence Agency said that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks should be treated as a foreign intelligence organization and that they were preparing to prosecute Julian Assange. What do you make of that? And how do you view Julian Assange? Should he be prosecuted?
I have pretty complicated feelings on Julian Assange because, like I think most journalists, I thought that the initial WikiLeaks disclosures of what was known as Cablegate was extremely valuable to understanding the murky and shadowy world of our alliances in the war on terror. And ultimately, that I think did a lot of good in sort of bringing out in the open the total hypocrisy of our relationship with countries like Yemen and Pakistan and places like that. And I'm grateful for it, and I use it as a resource as a journalist. And I still do use those WikiLeaks as a resource. On the other hand, what Julian Assange did is he published hacked emails. He claims he does not know the source. He disputes it, but I don't find his explanations credible by any stretch. And this is another form of...
Meaning you feel that the source is Russian or elsewhere?
I believe that the source is the GRU. I believe
the GRU, US, which is
Russian military
Russian
intelligence.
Military intelligence.
And I don't believe WikiLeaks at one point, like OJ looking for the real killers, suggested it was this guy Seth Rich who worked for the DNC and who was horribly murdered and tried to sort of say these two things were connected, further causing misery for this poor guy's family. But... one way to look at what WikiLeaks did in the case of the Podesta hacks and the Democrat hacks is an incredible violation of privacy. And so when a government would do something like that, we would be outraged. The idea that our personal communications would be monitored and then disclosed is what a police state does. That when I lived in Egypt, this was a classic tactic when you knew somebody was out of favor with Hosni Mubarak, the former dictator. Now, in this case, WikiLeaks is not a government, but there is some news value to some of those emails. So it's not an easy call for me.
Says who?
Well, I mean, I think you have to say that, you know, finding out that there was dissent within the kind of Clinton campaign.
That was surprising.
With regards to the Clinton Foundation. No. With regard to the Clinton Foundation, and specifically that we knew that Chelsea was on one side of this, and that there was a buck-raking scheme where Clinton was kind of double-dipping in ostensibly what he was supposed to be doing in terms of, I mean, I don't know, I don't remember exactly all the details. I thought that memo was extremely newsworthy. It told us a lot about what might be called the monetization of Bill Clinton's ex-presidency.
But Eli, you know where we're going to go on this question. So it's a question of whose ox is gored here.
I agree with you.
It becomes an ideological question.
No, but
what's
newsworthy? I don't mean it to be ideological. I'm trying to say that it's complicated.
Right.
Because that kind of invasion of privacy, when it's done by a foreign government, is horrendous. That is the worst. And we wouldn't accept it if it was our government doing it, and we shouldn't accept it if it's the Russian government doing it. On the other hand, there is legitimate news value in those emails. So I think it's a hard call on Julian Assange.
But you know what happens when it becomes a hard call. Somebody jumps, it goes into print, and that's the end of the game.
I agree.
David?
I mean, I think that was right. I think there was an attitude on our part. I sit next to the folks who cover those things that they were going to be out there anyway. It was our responsibility to look at them and see what was newsworthy. I don't think in the end the actual contents of those emails had that much of an effect on the election, but certainly it was something we felt like if it was going to be covered, we should be doing it as well.
I totally disagree. I mean, we didn't use any of the WikiLeaks, and I made it very clear on my show that we weren't going to use them because I think they were the product of a foreign government attempting to interfere in the election. I thought most of the emails that were disclosed, particularly the Podesta stuff, was just gossip. And it did have a material effect because the intended effect of releasing...
Would you use it if it had been the other way around, if it had been stuff on Trump that was really awful?
I think that the Access Hollywood is sort of the flip side of that, right? Where you have
A foreign government.
Right, but exactly. And that's the difference. I think that in the case of Access Hollywood, this was actual behavior by someone whose attitude toward women was a factor in the campaign. The sort of gutter sniping between DNC people, who obviously as Democrats didn't really care for the idea of an independent getting the nomination.
Wait a minute, Joy,
how was that newsworthy?
Can't you twist this as you will to make it
ideological.
In other words, you say, well, from a Republican point of view, I just learned all about, as Eli was pointing out, I just learned all about debates within the campaign and buckraking, and I'm, and by the way, Goldman Sachs speeches.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that the news media, and first of all, we had a guy called Malcolm Nance, and one of the things he said to us early on, back in July, when the first WikiLeaks dumps came out, timed to coincide with the convention, with the goal of trying to get sort of Bernie Sanders supporting Democrats to not vote for Hillary Clinton. That was the goal of it, was to sort of drag her down in order to hurt her chances either of election or if she won to sort of, you know, sort of undermine her presidency, right? So, and one of the things that Malcolm Nance said is that the reason that you don't use hacked material is that you can't necessarily trust it. You don't know, for instance, whether or not in spoofing and taking these emails, if anything's been changed. You don't know if they've been altered. And how would you remember
Clinton
if
campaign,
somebody had
20,000... Clinton campaign never denied that they
because
were
Because how can you? If I said to you, I have an email of yours from 13 months ago,
I immediately
can
go
you
to
tell
my
me
email
if it's
and
yours?
I check it out.
Yeah. I mean, the reality is, I think, that because you couldn't be sure of the product and because the product came from a foreign hack, in my mind, these were not something that we should be using. I disagreed with my own news organization on this.
Lydia.
And we personally didn't use them on my show.
I'm with you on this. I mean, I'm with David. I feel like, you know...
Would you have published the now famous...
dossier?
That's the one. This is what... Just to fill in the spaces, BuzzFeed, as a lot of news organizations, were in possession of the so-called famous Christopher Steele dossier, which contained material about Kremlinology and also activities at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel that were less than dry. So CNN came on the air and said, there is this dossier, President of the United States and the President-elect have been President-elect by then? Have been informed of this, and it's been summarized for them. 48 seconds later, BuzzFeed put the dossier up. And this dossier had been in the hands of some news organizations. I am ashamed to tell you one of them was not the New Yorker.
Oh. I know. I was like, what am I, a chopped liver?
Exactly.
Same.
Exactly.
Yeah. Evidently. You know, I think that that was a very carefully considered decision by BuzzFeed that was extremely congruent with their view of journalism, which is that if a bunch of people are talking about something and there is a closed circle in which people are discussing this document that has great import, that the public should know about it. I didn't have the document. I didn't have to make that decision. I am very sympathetic to BuzzFeed's point of view on that.
People think that because Trump has broken all these rules of normal behavior by a politician, that by covering him, we can cover him by breaking the rules as well. But the reason we have trust in us is that people know that if we put something out, we know that it might be real, that it is real, and that it has relevance. And in this case, just put out this dossier whose authority was completely unproven just because people were talking about it, I felt like that was the wrong decision.
Barack, just quickly interject.
Please, Lydia, go ahead.
The Pew Trust last year in their survey, 18% of respondents said they had a lot of trust in national media. So
18.
Put that in your pipe.
Fantastic. Okay, that was going to be my last question. You know, we're up here speaking with a lot of confidence, some disagreement, some agreement, and yet we are roundly, and I say this with utter confidence because the Pew Trust told me so, and they tell me every goddamn year, we are not adored. We are
speak
not adored.
We're
sorry?
Speak for yourself.
Have you seen this guy's Twitter mentions? Right. They're incredible.
The guy has had a great year. Your time will come, my friend. Your time will come. Everybody adores David, but with the exception of David, why are our ratings so low? Why are we mistrusted? I mean, we are. Are we lower than Congress?
I don't think anyone is lower than
Congress. Okay. Congress is like single digit. Single
so, okay. Digit. So, all right. So, mission accomplished. But it's still not where we would like it to be. Eli, why is that?
I always, when I see that, I always think to myself, would you rather have, like, British press, which publishes anything and has an official Secrets Act? Would you rather have the Israeli press, which is crazy? And as you know, having recently done that really great profile of Haaretz. I'm speaking of bias here, but I think that one of the strengths of the American press, especially now in the era of the internet, is you can get any number of vantage points. You still have a number of organizations, I wish we had more, that are doing serious work. And, you know, I'm kind of angry at the American people that they don't appreciate us more.
So your grievances with the American people is the most honest
response. I take it to the American people. They have no idea how good they have it. We have a terrific media, and I'm sick and tired of us being derided by politicians.
Because usually what we do in these panels is,
I know, we're supposed to feel bad about it, but
we
shouldn't feel bad about it.
We must do better.
We work very hard. The industry's been cratering,
as you pointed out. The cartoons are hilarious.
Yeah, the cartoons are really good. No. We write good English.
Yeah.
I'm just sorry that we just chose a new slogan. If I'd known, you don't know how good you have it, was
okay,
available.
Can we discuss? Does everybody know the new slogan of the Washington Post? Would you like to tell us, David?
Democracy dies in darkness. I can't do that without sort of Dracula playing the organ sound effect.
Dean Baquet, with glee in his eyes, the editor of the New York Times, said that it sounded like
a Batman movie.
Yeah. Okay. But it's true. Democracy does die in darkness. So why aren't we more adored, Joy?
See, you know, I think it's sort of the way people do feel about Congress, in that they say they hate Congress, but they like their congressman. And generally, people who say they hate Congress still reelect their incumbent politicians. And so I think what you find is the answer is partisanship. People want to hear their own inner core reflected on their TV and in their news media that they read. And to the extent that they hear their own inner voice reflected back, they like and trust it. To the extent that anything is making them uncomfortable or is refuting their point of view, they think it's a lie. And we've gone to the point where people don't just say, that point of view that is opposite to mine is opposite to mine. If it is opposite to mine, it is a lie. And that's the way that we've sort of trained ourselves up over the last 40 years or so, when partisan media came in and filled the void and said, we will give you your own voice reflected back at you.
Media was always partisan. Media used to belong, American newspapers used to belong, as you know better than I do, to political parties. That this whole objective New York Times pre- and post-war thing, mm-hmm. that's a really narrow moment in history.
I mean, I think we're also talking about newspapers. I mean, what we really need to talk about is television, right? I mean, I don't know if any of you read the profile of Jeff Zucker in the New York Times Magazine, but it's clear that this is a person who views his work through the lens of entertainment and sports, right? And so he's gathering up, you know, these people to have these gladiator fights, and it doesn't matter if anything is true or if anything is important. It's just about ginning up these shout fests. I mean, you just feel like your head's going to explode.
Can I just, in defense of my rival network, just for a moment? I think a lot of the critiques of cable news are accurate, right? We're trying to fill 24 hours of time, and it is entertainment in a sense, right? Because people no longer view the news as the voice of God; they view it as, again, my own point of view distributed to me with entertaining sort of voices, right? Interesting people. And to the point that you made, in the opening point you made, I was watching it today and thinking to myself, we are sending professionals, either journalists or advocates, to go on television and debate nothing. The pro and con merits of whether we should string a Berlin Wall across the southern border that everyone who's a thinking, sentient person knows is a ridiculous idea. And you're asking people to sit there and debate it.
Except one. The guy.
But does he even believe
it? He doesn't even know. I mean, the thing is, when you're asking someone to debate things Donald Trump says, again, read the AP transcript.
In fairness, that got a lot of support during the campaign.
It did, but he didn't believe. I mean, like, does this man have any fixed beliefs, right?
I mean, again, I would answer that the same way. I don't disagree with you.
Right.
He won the election.
In which 56% of Americans didn't even bother to vote.
So last time.
Right. He won less than half of the people who bothered to vote.
These are the rules of the game.
Exactly. And so the reality is that because it is a sort of content-free press, it's sort of there's a lot of it that's ridiculous. And so asking people to debate the ridiculous is very difficult. Yeah. And so you have essentially all you can do is sort of yell back and forth across. I mean, we had a big debate last fall over whether we should keep having Trump surrogates on. These are people with no experience in policy. For the most part, they just found them somewhere. Katrina Pearson, these other people, they don't know anything. I mean, what are we going to debate about? And so you're having them on to simply have an argument about nonsense. And so is this edifying the viewer? Are you learning anything at the end of the debate? And we went through a whole period where we just didn't have any of them on, because what was the point? First of all, if people are going to lie to you, and let's just talk about that for a moment. If Kellyanne Conway is going to come on your TV show and tell blatant lies, you can't debate her about them because they are lies. What's the point?
But is that a novelty completely, or is it just the degree to which she does it?
Not in this administration, it is de rigueur. It's what they do. Sean Spicer is made
but
to stand up and lie.
But you've been lied to before by other administrations.
Oh, absolutely, but not to this extent with this... this sort of, it's constant. It's sort of like a stream of brazen, blatant, constant lying to the point where the debate itself becomes absurd.
Thank you so much, Joy and Eli and David and Lydia. Thank you.
That was David Remnick with Lydia Polgreen of the Huffington Post, Eli Lake of Bloomberg View, Joy Reid of MSNBC, and David Fahrenthold of the Washington Post. They were together on April 24th as part of Public Forum at the Public Theater. Thanks for listening.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.